Hey everybody, my name is Jason Biddick and I am an alcoholic.
Hi Jason.
My sobriety date is January 15th, 2013. I have a home group. It's the Big Book Group in Bellflower, California. I've got a sponsor in that group. His name is Todd L. I met my wife in that group. We got married in my sponsor's backyard. And I am grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the 10-minute speaker. You were awesome. Anytime someone's talking about peeing in the bed, I know I'm in the right place. I want to say happy birthday to the birthday people. I know they're going to be coming up in a little bit. When I was new again, and I started coming back to meetings again, I was going to a men's stag meeting where all of these guys were passing around these lists every single morning to each other, like, you know, I'm grateful for my car, I'm grateful for my house, my beautiful wife, my, you know, these gratitude lists, right? And I knew that if I continued going to the same type of meetings, I was going to end up with the same type of result. You know, I had tried getting sober before and it didn't work. And I had heard a bunch of speakers from Bellflower, and every single time they got up behind the microphone, they carried a message of depth and weight. And I never want to forget that Alcoholics Anonymous is supposed to be a safe haven for the suffering and not a showcase for the contented. It is nothing more than one beggar showing another beggar where the bread is. And I'm just grateful to be alive and grateful to be here. You know how, you know, when you're doing God's will, everything in your life is just extremely smooth. You know, time just flies by. There's no conflict anywhere. And my entire beginning of this week was just like that. I was just having the greatest week. And you just know that you're doing God's will. But then came yesterday, and I got a flat tire. Then last night, I had a conversation with somebody, and I couldn't shake that conversation. And I was up almost all night thinking about it over and over and over and over and over. And I got up today and had some trouble at work, and then my wife pulled in at noon screaming at me that there was a mouse in her car, and she thought that if the mouse bit her toe, she could crash and kill somebody, and it's 110 degrees, and I'm out trying to get a mouse out of her car during the day, and I'm thinking, this is not God's will. There's no way this is God's will. And I started imagining a text message, like, Mark, I hate to do this to you, but there's no way I'm going to be able to make it today. I think God wants me to be home on the couch today. It is not his will for me to drive all the way up to Lancaster. There's just no way. Anyways, I am grateful to be here. You know, if you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you're new and this is your very first time especially, I didn't get sober my very first attempt. And I don't even remember the speakers when I was brand new either. I just remembered where I was. I remember who smiled at me. I remember who shook my hand. Those are the things that I remember when I was new. So I'm just going to jump right in. You know, I grew up in Orange County. You know, my parents were both college educated. They were really good parents. My dad did just well enough where my mom didn't have to work. I was a class clown every year in school. Back then, they thought I was hyper, or they called it like attention deficit disorder. And I think I remember in fifth or sixth grade, they would give me Ritalin because they wanted me to focus on school. But I was already deeply selfish and self-centered. And what that means is I could focus on what I wanted to focus on. And if you gave me Ritalin, I could really focus on what I wanted to focus on. And I can promise you it was not school. It wasn't going to happen. So they took me off that, you know, immediately. Everybody on my street, you know, we had one season where we played soccer, and then everybody moved from that season over to playing Little League. You know, we were all athletes. You know, my dad actually was an Olympian, and I looked up to him. You know, he went to church, and he was the type of guy that everyone on the street and everyone that he went to church with, they always seemed to wanted to go and talk to him. Anytime they needed anything, he was larger for life, and he was just a really good man. And I wanted to be like my dad, you know, when I grew up. And as I rolled into junior high school, I was playing so many sports that had all-star teams that approached into the summer that my mom said, look, you're going to stop doing that because you're ruining vacations. And so they said, well, maybe you should just go play golf. And that sounded good to me. And so in junior high, they started taking me to the golf course and just dropping me off all day long. At that same time, we took a family vacation down to Carlsbad. And I was playing a bunch of football with some Marines that were out there. And when they were done playing football, I just followed them back to their room, right? And went into the room, and they had a a bar set up on the side and no one seemed to be saying anything to me. And if someone isn't telling me no, I'm just going to keep doing what I want to do. And I walked over and I poured a Southern Comfort and a little bit of La Paz drink mix, and I went and sat in the corner and I took a drink, you know, and I took another drink. And I remember about 4 or 5 minutes later, all of a sudden I started feeling something that I had never felt before. And I can tell you, I can look back on that experience. I know where the sun was in the sky. I know where everybody was sitting. I felt like at that time I had my very first spiritual experience. And if you knew, what I'm trying to say is I loved to drink. From the very first time I ever had a drink, I just absolutely loved it. I wasn't drinking to hide from anything. I wasn't drinking because I had feelings associated to anything. I drank because I loved the effect produced by alcohol. And by the time I got into high school, on weekends, I'd be drinking every opportunity I had. And I also started to play golf a lot more. You know, by the time I was a sophomore in high school, like, I won my league championship. But by the time I was a senior in high school, I was like the LA Times High School Golfer of the Year, Orange County Register High School Golfer of the Year. I had one CIF individual, I won CIF team, the Southern California Junior Championship. I won the Southern California PGA Junior Championship. And then I qualified for my very first PGA Tour event when I was a senior in high school. The youngest person in the history of the PGA Tour to play a tour event on the West Coast. And if you were to ask me what my life was going to look like at that time, I would have looked at you in the eye and told you, I'm going to go off to college and I'm going to be an All-American. And I'm going to get out of college, and I'm going to turn professional, and I'm going to make a ton of money, and I'm going to buy a house and have a beautiful wife and a couple of kids, and I'm going to be famous. It's going to be awesome. And I truly believe that was going to happen. But as I was a junior and senior in high school, and everybody would look at me and see all the golf on the weekends, I was going out with my friends, and I was drinking myself to a point where I'd end up sleeping on a bathroom floor. And I didn't care. It just wasn't that big of a deal to me. I loved to drink. And I loved to play golf, and I wanted to figure out how on earth could I just drink and play golf the rest of my life. We need to crack the code, because this is going to be great if I can do it. And you know, I went on recruiting trips all over the United States. You know, I had two the summer before I turned 18. I had two national tournaments that I went to go play in, one in New York and one up in Canada. And I had a fake ID by this time, and I would get away from my parents. And I'd be up playing in these tournaments, and when I wasn't playing, I'd be off at the liquor store and drinking. And I got into a fight at a 7-Eleven, and I was representing California up in Canada playing a tournament. And I roll up to the first tee, and I got a black eye, and I can't see, and I'm trying to get the tee in the ground. And there's college coaches looking at me wondering what on earth I just did. And I'm just trying to drink and play golf, and everybody would just leave me alone. Everything is going to be fine. And, you know, about a month later, I'm down in West Palm Beach playing golf. And before the first round even starts, my entire bathtub in my hotel room is full of beer. Because it just makes sense to me that I'm away from my parents. All I want to do is just drink and play golf. I'm going to be able to make this work. Trust me. You know, my parents by then were trying to give me a lot of advice. My mom would should all over me. She would tell me, you should do this, and you should do this, and you should do this. And I would tell her things like, look, I didn't ask you for your opinion. I know what I'm doing. Just leave me alone. And my dad would say, why are you always going out on a limb? And I'm a smartass. So it's like, well, that's where the fruit is. Leave me alone. And I just knew that I was going to be a success. And finally, I went off to a major university here on the West Coast and immediately started drinking. You were talking about drinking a 12-pack in 2 hours, which I absolutely loved. I found a guy that I drank with that drank like me, and what we would do is we would start every night, and we had to drink one beer every 5 minutes for the first hour. So we had to get a 12-pack in us in an hour, and then what are we going to do? I don't know. We're going to figure something out, right? We just love to drink and go out and just have fun. But here's the problem. The third week of school, I got thrown in jail on Tuesday and Thursday in the same week, and I was kicked out of college before the end of September. I didn't make it through even one semester, you know. And so what do parents do here in Southern California when their kids get in trouble and drinking? I know what my parents did. Next thing you know, I'm a teenager and I'm going off to rehab, you know, and I'm in Costa Mesa and I'm sitting here with all these counselors, and you know, they want to talk about my discipline and they want to try to get in touch with my inner child and examine my relationship with my father and all those things that in my experience have absolutely nothing to do with long-term sobriety. But I learned a very valuable lesson at that time too. And this was in October of 1986. What I learned was, if I had a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and went to a meeting, my parents would leave me alone. And that's all I really wanted. I would tell you in a meeting that I was an alcoholic, but I had no idea what an alcoholic was. You know, I just know that I just loved to drink and I didn't want to be in trouble. So, you know, I would go to these meetings, didn't get a sponsor, didn't go through the steps. And about 9 months later, I started drinking again. And now my parents, they've been through, you know, a little bit of the therapy with their son. And so, you know, they said, look, son, you can do whatever you want. You know, you can't stay here. And I was convinced at this point that, you know what, the problem has to be that I have a discipline problem. So I went and I joined the United States Marine Corps. And I'm telling you, I was fine in boot camp. And I was fine in the School of Infantry. And I was fine at Camp Lejeune. I was fine at Camp Pendleton. But I go off to my first duty station, and I'm in Okinawa, Japan. And now I can start drinking again. And now I'm just angry. You know, I went from being, you know, a junior high and high school kid that was just wanted to tell jokes and have fun and laugh, to now it's, how come I'm not playing golf? How come I have to shave my head, which now isn't that big of a deal? Why are people yelling at me all the time? I'm only making $800 a month and I'm living on the other side of the planet. Screw you. I'm just going to drink. I'm going to drink every chance I get. And I'm 21 years old, and I'm working from 5 in the morning until about 4 in the afternoon. And I try to go to sleep at 4 o'clock and sleep till about 9. And then I get up and I go out into town. And I, every night I drink from 9 until about 4 in the morning. And then I got to get a taxi back to base. And I have to start, you know, and I have to get to work. And I started to see that alcohol was a problem. You know, this is the first time that I was able to determine that maybe alcohol is playing a role in this. And so my solution at that time was, I'm going to a Navy corpsman, and I'm going to go ahead and ask for a prescription of Anabuse. So just give me Anabuse. And if you don't know what Anabuse is, I had heard that it was developed in the early 1970s to give to people coming out of prison that had, you know, a lot of alcohol offenses. And what it does is it goes into your liver, and if you drink at all, you can have a severe reaction, and it could even kill you. And I just thought, you know what, if I just know that I'm taking this stuff, I won't drink. Not that big of a deal. And I was about 10 days into it, and I'm in the Marine Corps barracks, and I'm sitting next to my roommate, and I'm playing a video game, and he's drinking gin and juice, because that's what we used to drink. And next thing you know, not even paying attention, I had a drink. And next thing you know, I had another drink. And he looks at me, and he looks at me again, and he goes, man, you need to go look at yourself in the mirror. And I went, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and it was like I had a line down the middle of my face, and half my face was beet purple. And I took off my shirt, my entire back was purple. I was having a tough time breathing, and I made a huge choice right then, and that was, I will not take Anabuse ever again. But what a terrible idea that was, right? The hell was I doing? I was 21 years old taking Anabuse. How stupid can I be? So I just was going to go out and just drink and see if I could just figure it out and see how long I could make it last. And then there was finally a day that came that I rolled into work at 5:30 in the morning, and I told my staff sergeant, I said, look, I'm not working today. Now, you can do that at Denny's. You cannot do that in the United States Marine Corps. You cannot tell your boss that you're not going to be working. I ended up losing all of my rank, getting put on house arrest. But I just didn't care, you know. I mean, for those of you that are new, what I can relate to is, you know, it's men and women who have lost all hope, it can be pretty dangerous, and it's a very dangerous time. I just didn't know what could you possibly do to me. I'm not doing what I want to do. You're going to threaten me by telling me I need to stay in my dorm and play video games all day. I could use some choice words, but I just didn't care. There's nothing that you could do to me. I was very defiant. And finally, they said, look, do you think you would want to go to rehab again? And I know what that means when they tell me something like that. And what that means is I better say yes or I'm going to be in trouble. And so now I'm 21 and I'm going into my next rehab. And we show up that day and there's 6 of us that are going in. And they were asking each one of us, you know, when was your last drink? You know, a week ago. When was your last drink? 2 weeks ago. When was your last drink? And they asked me, and it's like, man, I had a drink in the shower, because I'm a beer in the shower guy. You know, I don't have a soap on the soap dish. I have a ring on there from my Budweiser can. That sounds funny, but I drink in the shower. And so they put me into a hospital bed, and I was there for a couple of days because they didn't want me to have a seizure. And next thing you know, I'm sitting in front of a counselor who wants to help me get in touch with my inner child. And they want to, you know, develop my, you know, find out about my relationship with my family. And, you know, they want to talk about my diet and all these things that the medical world wants to give an alcoholic of my type that has absolutely nothing to do with long-term sobriety in my experience. And I was there for 100 days, and I thought that this is just going to be no big deal. I felt physically as strong as I had felt in a long, long time. And when I got out, I went back to the barracks, and now everyone's drinking and going out, and I'm all by myself, you know. And I'm not thinking about going to a meeting. I'm not thinking about getting a sponsor, going through the steps. I'm not thinking about having a spiritual experience and developing a relationship with God. I'm sitting around going, what the hell am I doing in Okinawa, Japan? All by myself. Screw this. I hate this place. And next thing you know, I'm taking a drink. And it took about another month or two before they came to me and said, Jason, we want you to leave our United States Marine Corps. And they kicked me out. And I go back to Yorba Linda, where my parents are. And they know enough now that it's okay, you can stay here, but you have to stay sober. And it's like, okay, I'll do it. And you know what? I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, you know, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. You know, the good news is get a sponsor and do some steps. I mean, you're going to get some of your stuff back. You know, you're going to get a car, you know, maybe a relationship, place to stay, you know, things like that. That's the good news. The bad news is, in my experience, none of those things has anything to do with the solution to your problem today. And I jumped into Alcoholics Anonymous, and things got good really, really quick. You know, about 3 years into it, I met my wife, and then we had my son Palmer, and then we had my daughter Peyton, and we bought a little house. It had a white picket fence, and that's no joke. I mean, it actually had a white picket fence, right? You read about these things, and we were living in a little golf course community, and while I was working, I was actually coaching the high school golf team and just donating my time, and here's the problem. With every one of these life events, it was one less meeting, one less meeting, one less meeting, one less meeting, until I convinced myself that I was going to get all the spirituality that I needed at church. Now, that works for people. It actually does work for people. But in hindsight, when I look at my experience at church, I was using it as a history lesson. I was learning all the individuals. I was learning all the books. I was learning all the teachings. I was not using it as a relationship-building activity. And by about 8 years of sobriety, I was losing my mind. My father got cancer at year eight. In my experience, and what the book says, is if we fail to perfect and enlarge our conscious contact with God through hard work and self-sacrifice, we are not going to survive the certain low spots that we have ahead. And that was definitely a certain low spot. And I was completely detached from Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad was going through chemo and radiation treatments, and then he died. And now I don't know how I'm supposed to feel. I don't know what I'm supposed to even do. You know, my wife at that time started off as an elementary school second grade teacher. And by the time I was eight years sober, she was now an elementary school principal. And what that means is she's leaving at 6 in the morning and not getting home till 7 or 8 at night. Now I'm taking the kids to school, getting them ready in the morning. I'm picking them up when school's out, and I'm feeding them dinner, and I'm getting resentful. I'm getting resentful that I'm having to do all of this stuff. And my wife is saying on Saturday that, look, we're going to go do some family stuff. And I'm like, I don't know where you've been. I've been doing family stuff all week. I ain't doing family stuff right now. I'm not. I look back on it, and what I wouldn't pay right now to be able to go back then and be the dad that I would be now. But at that time, I was just resentful that she was off trying to build her career, and you know, even though I was working, you know, I had all of these added responsibilities that I didn't think was right. And I'm detached from AA. I'm detached from God. All I can do is think about myself and how this affects me. And I begin thinking that the only reason I'm feeling like I'm feeling is because she doesn't love me the way I deserve to be loved, you know. And it's a tough thing to be thinking, you know. And I'm trying to make a case and convince myself that my kids shouldn't be forced to grow up in a loveless house or whatever the hell that I was telling myself. And at about 12 years sober, I was walking through an airport, and I put the kids and my wife on an airplane. And I was flying somewhere else that day, and I still had 2 hours before my plane left. And I went and sat down in a bar, and I ordered 2 Budweisers. And I don't know why 2. Well, actually, I do know why 2. But I drank 2 Budweisers, and I started to immediately pick up drinking exactly where I left off. And I knew, and I'm someone that always was a beer drinker. You know, when they read at the beginning of chapter 3, drinking beer only, I learned early on if I was drinking something brown, the night was going to end early, and I wanted to have the night go. I wanted to stay up late drinking. I loved to drink, And I'm an analytical thinker too, and the way my brain was working was, okay, once I get to 8 beers, for every beer I drink, I go to the bathroom, and so it's an even swap. And so I'm just going to be at the 8 beer level all night, but if I drink 40 beers, that's fine, but I'm still just going to be there at 8. And one of the craziest things that I used to do to hide my drinking from my ex-wife is I used to go and I used to buy a 12-pack of non-alcoholic beer, and I would dump it out, and I would fill it up with Budweiser, and then I'd put the cap back on it, and I'd put it in the fridge, and she'd sit and watch me drink a 12-pack of non-alcoholic beer at night and not say a thing and not even worry about it, and I'm just like, oh, I got it fooled. Oh, my God, what a nightmare. And finally, you know, at 13 years of sobriety, you know, when I started drinking again, and it didn't take that long before I let her know that, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I got to leave. You know, my kids were 5 and 6 years old, you know, and that left her with a job where she had to work from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. with those two kids. And now I'm off just drinking all day long because that's all I know how to do and it's all I want to do. You know, I thought I would feel better when I separated from her, but it didn't take very long before I realized that the way that I was feeling had nothing to do with my relationship with her. And I started to feel guilt, shame, and remorse and needed to drink more and more and more and more. It didn't take long before that house went into foreclosure. My car got repossessed. They had to move back to Florida to be around my ex-wife now, you know, her family. You know, she had 6 brothers and sisters back there, so she went back to Florida to try to be with them and get some support because I wasn't giving them any support at all. And in fact, I made them stay in California for a year because I have my rights, even though I was only seeing them once every 2 or 3 weeks. And then the thought came to me that, you know what, I know deep down inside of me that there's a good dad. Regardless of what I've done the last few years of my drinking, I know I'm a good dad. So I'm going to go back to Florida. Things are going to be different this time. I went back there and I got a job where I had full control of my schedule. And I was living about 3 miles away from these kids that I love so much. And if you would have asked me on a Sunday what my week was going to look like, I'd have told you, I'm picking up my daughter on Tuesday and I'm taking her to dance. And then I'm picking up my son on Thursday and I'm taking him to Little League. And then Friday, I'm picking them both up. And we're going to stay in our pajamas all weekend and we're going to watch cartoons and we're eating pancakes 3 meals a day because screw it, it's going to be an awesome weekend. That's the dad I'm going to be. I swear to God, that's what we were going to do. But Tuesday would roll around and I would be at the bar. And I'm watching the clock and I'm trying to figure out how many drinks I can get in the next 90 minutes. And the closer I get, next thing you know, I'm texting my ex-wife that my boss is making me work late. I can't go see my daughter tonight. I can't do it. And Thursday would come around, the exact same thing would happen. I'd be sitting in the bar, and I had every plan to go pick up my son, but the closer we got to that time and the more the level of alcohol got in my system, I'm sending another text message, you know, to my ex-wife saying, I can't do this today. I just felt like, you know, what if it's not, if I'm not picking up my daughter on Tuesday, it wouldn't be fair to pick up my son on Thursday. You know, why don't I just go ahead and just get good and drunk this weekend? And then next week, you know what I'm going to do next week? I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do next week. I'm going to pick up my daughter on Tuesday and I'm going to take her to dance. And I'm going to pick up my son on Thursday and I'm going to take him to Little League. And I'm going to pick both of them up on Friday. And we're going to spend all weekend in our pajamas and we're going to watch cartoons and eat pancakes. It's going to be great. You know, I'm going to be the dad that I came out there to be. And I just couldn't do it. I went out there for the purpose of being that kind of a dad. And I ended up seeing them about once every 3 weeks. You know, Saturday mornings I would get up and I would go to Starbucks and I'd ask for a venti coffee double cupped. And I'd go to the gas station, get a 12-pack of Budweiser, and I'd try to drink the coffee on the way to the bar. I would dump that coffee out and take the outer cup, put it in the inner cup, fill it full of Budweiser, and walk into the bar about 2 hours early and just hang out with the bartenders as they were setting up and try to make it look like I was drinking coffee. And I would just drink all day. I just would drink all day. And on Sundays, we would go to a bar in downtown Orlando. And Sunday, it seemed like it was exactly the same every single Sunday. I would get there at 8 o'clock and buy a bucket of beer. And about halfway through the first beer, I'd feel something where I know I'm going to throw up. And I've done it so many times that I don't need to rush. I slowly walk to the bathroom. I go into the back stall. I heave 3 times. It's 3 times every time. I don't need to sit there and wait. I go wash my mouth out, and I go and I sit back down, and I start drinking that beer again. And about halfway through that second beer, I start feeling that same thing. Slowly walk just back to the bathroom, hit that back stall, heave three times, get that out of my system. Don't need to wait around any longer. Go back, wash my mouth out, and go sit down. And then I'm into my third beer and my fourth beer, and something changes. All of a sudden, I can feel a little something. Now it's, you better give me two shots. I'm just trying to get back to level. I know I'm not going to throw up anymore. Man, today's going to be a great day. Oh, man, it is just awesome. I thought that I could somehow continue drinking like that for the rest of my life. I started having to go to the doctor because my stomach kept getting tweaked out. You know, he was doing these colonoscopies and upper GIs until he asked me how much I drank, and then he just laughed and said, "We don't need to test you anymore. You just need to stop drinking." And I couldn't stop drinking, and I didn't want to stop drinking. There was no effort to control it. I had given up. I felt like my best life was behind me. My kids don't need me. The people at work don't like me. I don't have any friends other than the bartenders. I'm just going to drink myself to death. And I decided that, you know what, I remember when I was younger, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe I should try to do that again. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I drank before the meeting, and I drank after the meeting, and I went home. And I drank the whole next day, and I went to another meeting, and I drank before the meeting, and I drank after the meeting. It tells us in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that for many of us, you know, a definite hospital stay is in order, and for me, that was the case. And so AA wasn't going to work because I couldn't stop drinking, even go to a meeting, and I was able to get into a rehab. And I went into this rehab, and on the second day of the rehab, I walked up to the nurse's station. I said, "Look, I checked myself in here, right?" And they said, "Well, yes, you did." And I said, "Well, I need to check myself out." And, you know, this is 12 years ago. I had, you know, a big old beard. I'm wearing a hoodie. I'm wearing a hat. I looked angry because I was angry. And I said, "Look, I need to check myself out." And the lady said, "Well, that's against doctor's orders. Like, I don't care about your doctor. You're going to get me out of here right now." She's just like, "All right." And I remember, you know, about 10 minutes later being released, and I remember walking out to my car, and it was a gravel parking lot, and I'll never forget the rocks underneath my feet and the sound of those rocks as I was walking towards my car. And they talk about the four horsemen here in Alcoholics Anonymous, terrible will limit, frustration, and despair. And I had hit a point at that time that I thought that there was going to be no hope for me. I had just tried AA. I had just tried rehab. I'm done. I need to figure out how to end this. I just want freedom. I don't care how it looks. I don't care if I'm dead. I don't care if I'm sober. I just need to be free. I can't do this anymore. I can't do it. I found a parking structure that was six stories high, just accidentally, that didn't have a fence around it. And I, you know, for the first time in my life, I knew how I was going to do it. You know, I finally knew how I was going to do it. And the day came for that to happen, and I was detained and put into a behavioral health facility, not of my choosing, back in Florida. It's called Baker Acting. I went into the psych ward. You know, it was, and thank God I went into that psych ward where I couldn't get out. I remember, like, on the third day being in that psych ward, and there was a guy that walked in that had gauze around his neck, and he had blood on the gauze. And I remember asking this guy, what on earth did you do? He said, "Well, I was just really drunk, and I thought I should swallow a razor blade." And I remember sitting there saying, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. And back in the corner, a guy chimes up and says, "Yeah, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program." Here were two people in the psych ward that could probably recite a portion of chapter 3, a portion of chapter 5, tell you the 12 steps, talk about Bill's story and the doctor's opinion, and Dr. Silkworth that could not breathe a sober breath. I was in there for 5.5 days, went back to my apartment, and I'm telling you, when I opened the door to my apartment, there weren't people jumping up from behind the couch saying, "Welcome home." There was no balloons and glitter. I was by myself. You know, if you're new and you know that loneliness, I'm glad you're here. It was a loneliness I'd never felt before. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And during the break, you know, I'm smoking cigarettes, and I'm smoking one after another, like it's an Olympic event. You know, I'm uncomfortable. And this old timer comes up and says, "Son, you know, when there's an accident victim laying on the side of the road, when do you think the paramedic should start working on him?" And I said, "Well, right then." And he said, "Son, you've been in a terrible accident. We don't get together and start doing some step work, you're going to die." And you know what? No greater truth had ever been spoken to me. And I looked at that man and I said, "Tell me what to do. Just tell me what to do. I don't care what it is. I will do anything that you tell me to do." And if you're new and you want to know what a sponsor is, it's not some authority figure or some kind of a dictator. It's just somebody who's found some freedom through the 12 steps that's willing to show you how it is that they've done it. And if you want to do it, great. If you don't, that's fine. I'm busy, you're busy. We can each go our same direction. But at that time, I just said, tell me what to do. And he got me a big book and he sent me home and he asked me to read the doctor's opinion. Now, I say that now, it didn't sound like a lot. At the time, it seemed almost insurmountable to have to go home and read a chapter of the big book. It seemed like a lot. But I did it, and I got home. You know, I did it, and I went back to a meeting the next night. You know, then that man grabbed me again, and he says, why don't you go ahead and read Bill's story tonight? And the same type of thing. You know, by day 18, I was able to get back to California because I had been fired from my jobs. I had lost everything. And now I'm back in California where I knew some sober people, and I got a sponsor, and we opened up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and started reading through the doctor's opinion together. And you know what? In Bill's story, it talks about how, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about how Bill had come back to Dr. Silkworth and requested the privilege of going back into the hospital to share his experience, you know, with other patients. And that stood out to me because I hadn't done that. Here we are in 2013. You know, my first meeting was in 1986, and I had never gone out to try to help another guy stay sober. And I knew I had to do it, that there was no way around me going to do this. And so there was a detox in Costa Mesa, and I would go to a meeting in the morning, and I would go to this detox in the afternoon and try to learn to talk to these people, and then I would go to a meeting at night. And when I went there, I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to do it. I thought it was a terrible idea. I was convinced that maybe I needed to recover before going out and help these people. Turns out there is no recovery until an alcoholic of my type goes and tries to help these people. But the way it looked at the beginning was I would show up and I would say four things. Say, what's your name? Where are you from? How many days sober are you? I'm glad you're here. That's all I had. I memorized that. I didn't know anything else. I didn't know the big book. I didn't know anything. I was just trying to learn how to talk to somebody, a complete stranger. It sounds easy again from the microphone. It sounds easy. It was not easy. And I didn't want to do it. You know, but days went by, and as I'm reading the book, it said that it was important for an alcoholic of my type to carry a message that has both depth and weight. And what that means is I need to get some steps. I need to do some steps if I really want to help somebody. It does not matter how nice I am if I don't have steps to back up my talk and when I go and talk to you. And it had allowed me to go through the steps quicker, knowing that the reason I was doing it was to help somebody else. I thought I was a lost cause. I thought my life was over. But I thought maybe if I could help somebody, maybe that'll give me a purpose, you know. And when I was about 3 months sober, I went to a Friday morning meeting, and there was this kid who shared at this meeting who was about 19 years old. And I'm listening to this kid talk, and he's talking about how ashamed in himself he is, how disappointed he is in his life, how much he hates himself. You know, one of those shares that you're hearing going, this kid's going to drink. He's going to absolutely going to drink today. And I don't know what got into me, but at the end of the meeting, I said, son, what are you doing today? He says, I don't know. I said, well, you're going to spend it with me. And whether he wanted to or not, I was twice his size. He was going to spend the day with me. If I had to carry the message or I had to carry his butt to the car. You know, thankfully, he came willing. But, you know, I took him to Denny's and, you know, we had some breakfast, and I shared with him, you know, what it was like being 19 years old in Alcoholics Anonymous and being, you know, more worried about the clothes I was wearing and how my hair looked than my soul. And we talked all afternoon. You know, we went to the Canyon Club for a noon meeting, and he shared. And he still wasn't doing that good, but it didn't matter. You know, we were together. You know, we were together, and that's what was important. And you know, that night, we went to another meeting, and he shared at that meeting. But something had happened that afternoon. All of a sudden, he was grateful for his life. You know, he was happy about his situation. He loved his family. You know, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing coming out of this kid's mouth. I couldn't believe it. And when I went and dropped that kid off that night, man, I felt something inside of me that no drinking, no drug, no bank account, no woman, no nothing had ever given to me. And all I had to do was spend the day just trying to help a complete stranger staying sober. And I knew it. I knew you guys were right. And I also knew that moving forward, the only thing that I was going to have to do in order to have peace, in order to feel fulfilled, was to go out and try to take care of God's people. And then I knew God was going to take care of me. I didn't have any problem with that. You know, one of the greatest lessons, one of the greatest experiences that I've had here in Alcoholics Anonymous is now the understanding that the only thing I need to have to feel complete in my life, the only thing that I need to do is I need to love you. I need to love the people in this room. I need to love the people in my home group. I need to love my neighbor. I need to love my friends. I need to love my wife. I need to love my kids. That's all I need to do to feel complete. And I don't need any love from you. And I don't need any friendship. And I don't need a damn thing from anybody because I am complete. Now, my wife loves me. It's icing on the cake. I'm grateful for it. But I don't wake up in the morning and think I'm missing anything. And what a gift Alcoholics Anonymous is to provide an alcoholic of my type, a lesson of love. If you are new, and this is your very first visit with us here in Alcoholics Anonymous, or if you're new and you were like me and you've come in and out a few times, there isn't anybody, not your sponsor, not your friends, not your family, not the person sitting next to you. Nobody can look at you with any degree of certainty and tell you what your life's going to look like years from now, or even months from now for that matter. But I promise you this. You get a sponsor, stay in a strong home group like this, and go through these 12 steps, and your life will be different than it is today. And if you are an alcoholic of my type, anything different is an absolute miracle. You have taken a garden variety drunk like me. And just like the book says, you have made me happily and usefully whole again. And for that, I am grateful. Thank you.